This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Now to a man who for more than half a century has been considered by many to be America's consumer advocate in chief, Ralph Nader, an instrumental force behind safety standards for cars, cleaner water, whistleblower protections, and more. Nader has run for president four times and has spent a career challenging abuses of corporate power. He now has a book out today where he actually praises some uses of corporate power. Nader's found a dozen examples of company CEOs who he sees as being forces for good. Mr. Nader spoke to my colleague, David Brancaccio.
What's gotten into you, sir? Being nice to CEOs? Are you mellowing?
Well, after a lot of years going after the big CEOs for bad behavior, I thought we needed some comparative yardsticks, because if we don't have comparisons and contrasts by CEOs who got it right, it's hard to evaluate the CEOs who are not getting it right, because they always justify everything they're doing by saying, we're just responding to market demand. Over the years, I've got to know and learn about 12 CEOs in a whole variety of businesses who did it right.
You have some very big top-of-mind names among your list of 12. Yvon Chouinard, the Patagonia guy. But among the 12 you feature are some, I would say, non-household names at this point. Gino Pellucci from Minnesota. This guy founded 70 companies, Chunking Foods, some will remember, Gino's Pizza Rolls, many will remember. What should the world learn from Mr. Pellucci's example?
Well, he grew up real poor in the Iron Range of Minnesota, and he described conditions for the miners beyond belief. And he never forgot where he came from. So as he became more and more successful, he started out as a peddler. In fact, he said, almost all of us are peddlers. We're trying to sell something. And that was the title of his autobiography. And he was extremely successful as a salesman. And then he said, well, I'm going to go out on my own. And he started one company after another. But he was tremendously outspoken. Like, he wouldn't tolerate suppliers of packaging, for example, that messed up. He'd go right to the CEO to get the materials shaped up. He insisted on labor unions in his company, and he championed the cause of labor because, again, he never forgot where he came from and how horrible the conditions were in the workplace for his family.
I mean, it's an interesting approach, right? Because a CEO would have power to provide the benefits and compensation that might make a union unnecessary, yet he still thought the structure of unions were important for his employees.
He had a sense of, well, I'm the CEO and I come from a poor family and I'm going to respect my workers. But he also knew that that made the workers too dependent on him and whoever was in executive suite in his company. He wanted the workers to be assertive, which was something he did in company after company after company. Never had a strike. He's very proud of that.
Lots of interesting people on the list here in the book. Anita Roddick from The Body Shop. We interviewed her over the years. Herb Kelleher, that character, founder of Southwest Airlines. I mean, he was a character, right?
He was a lawyer, and he looked at the airline industry as being very stodgy. So he said, hey, I'm going to start the airline. I don't know a thing about airlines, but I know how to hire people who do. And he insisted on reversing the business model. So when Southwest was successful, he was the lowest paid executive among all the big airlines, United Airlines, Delta. And he was paid about $750,000 a year. And he was making more money than any of them for the company, more profit than any of them. And when I asked him why, he said, because I started with my people. He would never say associates or employees. If you treat our people well on the airlines and at the counter, they will treat the customers well. And the customers will fly on Southwest Airlines more. And that will make the shareholders happy. So that's what I mean by reversing the business model.
Now, we're speaking at a time that inflation is coming off its highs, but so many U.S. households are living paycheck to paycheck, 58% using the last count I saw. Now, you feature some CEOs in the book, thinking of John Bogle at Vanguard Investments and the Price Club boss. His name is Saul Price, actual name. These are people who worked to keep prices down for customers, but that possibly meant they left profits on the table. In other words, they could have made more profit, but that's not how they saw their mission.
Well, when it comes to John Bogle, who's really a great man in the history of corporations in our country, he broke the model of the hierarchical stock-held mutual fund like Fidelity and others. He started Vanguard, which now has $7.5 trillion in assets, the second biggest after BlackRock. He made it into a mutual company. So technically, if you invest your money in Vanguard funds or index funds, you're a part owner of the company. That way, he didn't have to get these calls from Wall Street analysts, and he was free to criticize his own industry and show them how they're gouging with their fee structure. You know, all these CEOs, David, had similar characters, although they had widely different personalities. But they had certain consistencies. And one was they had a vision for what the companies they're going to run was supposed to be for the society, for the economy. But they also paid a lot of attention in detail to profit, as Anita Roddick did with her many shops, as she called it. They also publicly admitted mistakes. Gino Pelucci would immediately admit the mistakes, why, say, his restaurants failed or why a product failed in public, as a way to motivate him to do better the next time. And second, they weren't secretive. Saul Price would give all his ideas about how to expand big box stores to his competitors. They weren't interested in building conglomerates. Kelleher was once said, you know, you got a big airline. Why don't you buy a hotel chain? He said, what do I know about a hotel chain? Why should I diffuse my attention? And they also criticized their own industry. John Bogle did, of course. Yvonne Chouinard of Patagonia did. The great Ray Anderson of the Interface Corporation Atlanta. That's the biggest carpet tile manufacturer in the world. And he decided early in the 21st century he was going to turn his company around, become carbon neutral.
A couple years ago, that influential club of CEOs, the Business Roundtable, had their big meeting of the year. And at that meeting, they agreed to work toward a kind of capitalism that would consider the costs and benefits to many different stakeholders. Yes, shareholders, of course, but also employees, the community, the earth. And some headlines followed that and some pledges. But I think many would say that Roundtable's initiative seems to have lost energy. Old habits die hard.
Yeah, that's right. They made some very nice statements about having their stakeholders include not just their workers and shareholders, but their consumers and environment. But they just left all these nice statements on the table as they went back to building their bottom line with the old-fashioned, well, we're just giving the market what it's demanding. And that's the only verdict that really counts. I do have one CEO who has five restaurants in Washington, D.C., Andy Shalal, an immigrant from Iraq at a very young age, and he really broke the model of traditional restaurants. You go into his restaurants now, and first you see a bookstore, and then the dining area with art on the walls that he created as an artist, and then there's a room with dining tables for civic activities. He would have poetry readings, politicians would come and speak, citizen groups would come, there would be debates while people were dining. And that three-part model has enriched the community of Washington, D.C.
What is it, among your hopes here for this book, is that maybe it would be added to, I don't know, business school curricula?
Yeah, there are just millions of students. There are business majors in undergraduate courses and, of course, business schools, and they need a book like this as part of their curriculum to elevate their expectations of the role of business in our country and alert them to what they may be required to compromise in terms of their own principles and keep their conscience at home by bad business practices. And that's what this book hopefully will help turn around.
Let me ask you something about you. Mr. Nader, you're still at it here. I think you have a big birthday coming this winter. Some of your critics probably wished you had retired 50 years ago or something, but here you are with this new project, this new book. Doesn't seem like you're going into retirement mode, huh?
No, not at all. A long time ago, when I was at Princeton, the world was not doing well. There was a threat of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. There was a lot of discouragement on campuses, a lot of fatalism. It was a time, you know, when they would tell elementary school students to get under the desk for air raid tests. So I went to the library and I studied the philosophers of pessimism, like Schopenhauer, sort of as a justification for being resigned to the world as it is. And I wasn't impressed. And I realized that pessimism has no function. And you have to be continually optimistic. And that the only real aging is the erosion of one's ideals.
Consumer advocate Ralph Nader, his new book, brand new, is called The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. Mr. Nader, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.